Hey, Lulu here. Whether we are romping through science, music, politics, technology, or feelings, we seek to leave you seeing the world anew. Radiolab adventures right on the edge of what we think we know, wherever you get podcasts.
I'm Tanzina Vega, and today's takeaway kicks off now. Yes, it's Men's World Cup time, and we'll get to all the World Cup games in a minute, but there are a handful of World Cup teams in the Muslim world. And as Ramadan comes to a close this week, fasting during the holy month has impacted how players train and raised questions about which athletes on the pitch will be fasting during these final days. Saudi Arabia played today, Morocco, Iran, and Egypt play tomorrow. So what does that mean for the Muslim players on soccer's biggest world stage? I asked Shireen Ahmed about all this. She's a sports writer and co-host of the feminist podcast, Burn It All Down.
There's a lot of discussion about whether they'll fast or whether they won't fast and how they'll observe Ramadan. Now, there's not one easy answer to this because, first of all, Muslims are not a monolith. And this might shock some people, but we make our own decisions about things. So particularly in an event such as the World Cup where there's training and it's their work, they might choose not to fast. Also, travelers aren't required to fast. They're expected to make it up later if they're healthy. They could technically not fast under that sort of clause as well. So I'm not sure. I know that the Iranian team does choose to fast, but they will be playing not today. They're playing tomorrow. The first match, I believe, is tomorrow.
And so we're also seeing that there are some very well-known Muslim players who are very open with their faith, both on the field and off the field. How new is that?
See, this is the thing. It's not. I know that because the last World Cup also hit during Ramadan. And the thing is, there was always this discussion, and so did the Euros, about, wow, this is this new thing. Muslims have been around for a really long time, and this isn't new. Footballers have been fasting and competing in major tournaments and championships for a very long time. And the thing we have to remember is that they wouldn't be doing something or observing something if their body hadn't been attuned and accustomed to it. It's not like they woke up all of a sudden and said, hey, we're going to fast today for 17 hours. That's not how it works. It's preconditioning. It's, you know, from a young age being exposed to this kind of practice. And, you know, for those that came to the faith later, it's understanding what it means. And also, these are professional athletes who have dietitians and nutritional experts at their disposal. So it's not as if their diets and their meals and their training sessions haven't been fully planned out.
And in terms of the openness and perhaps the prostrating in prayer when there's a goal, what impact could that have on fans who might not be as familiar with Muslim faith or might have their own stereotypical ideas of what it looks like?
I think in terms of bridge building, I think there is an important piece to that. I mean, we've seen Eric Abidal, who played in La Liga for Barcelona. He used to offer supplication and hold his hands up, just like, you know, Mesut Ozil does or Ribery does, who plays for Bayern Munich. It's not new. We've seen Dembaba, who plays for Chelsea, do prostrations. We've seen, and most recently, Mohamed Salah, who is the world's favorite. And I would arguably say the Muslim world favorite. He's playing for Egypt. Now, these aren't new things. Now, it may be new because we've seen them on the periphery, but to make it mainstream is what we're talking about now. To have one of football's most beloved players, Mo Salah, who's been given so many accolades this year, very seamlessly drop into prostration after scoring. So what this does is, and I there's a part of me that doesn't like the normalization of Muslims because we don't need to be normalized. Humanizing people that are already humans is for me, a very different conversation. But to segue that in, and some of the chants that, you know, the Liverpool Football Club supporters have been saying, something like, you know, if he scores again, I'll convert. Like, these are things that shouldn't be taken too lightly, but also there's a certain joy in that, because particularly when Islamophobia is definitely on the rise.
And we've also done a segment on the show where we talked about, you know, the potential for, or and not just the potential, but the history of racism, particularly in Russia, in football, in soccer. Have you heard of Muslim players who are dealing with that type of open Islamophobia on the field?
I haven't read anything as such. I mean, the closest I got to hearing about any type of reservations was a player on the English squad. Rose had mentioned that he had warned his family not to attend because they're black. And we've heard concerns from the LGBTIQ community about this, and they're very, very valid. And everybody has a right to be concerned because it's not, we've seen in the past in World Cups, I mean, it's a major tournament, it's a world event. We've seen, you know, militarization, displacement of homeless people, environmental genocide even, and I'm talking about Brazil specifically. We've seen all these things happen. There's human rights abuses while building stadiums. So it's not a big jump to say that we have other concerns in Russia. It's not a concern. As far as Islamophobia goes specifically, I don't think so, because one thing is the players are very heavily guarded. It's the concern for their families and their fans that would be the most pressing.
Shireen Ahmed is a sports writer and co-host of the Feminist Sports Podcast, Burn It All Down. Shireen, thank you for being with us as always.
Thank you so much for having me.
So we're talking about the Men's World Cup kicking off in Russia today. And did you know that 1 million people are expected to visit that country and more than 3 billion people are expected to watch worldwide? Well, today we have none other than Roger Bennett, the co-host of NBC's Men in Blazers and host of the new WNYC Studios podcast, American Fiasco. Roger, so great to have you with us.
Tanzina, is a joy to be with you.
Well, before we get into the specifics, I have to say, no Team USA, I don't know what to do. Convince me why I should watch, and you are a newly minted American citizen. Tell us, what's happening here?
You're probably breaking news, Tanzina, to many of your listeners who are waking up today, learning there's a World Cup, the excitement, and then finding out, oh my Lord, the USA are not in it. What is with that?
I mean, we knew we weren't at the top, but I didn't think we were here.
But then we find out there's no NITs in world football. It gets even worse. It is a dark reality. This is the best of times, the worst of times for US soccer. Yesterday, the USA, along with Mexico and Canada, found out that they have been awarded the 2026 World Cup, a game changer for the profile of the sport in this country. In a way, 1994 put it on the map. 2026, the World Cup, that big footballing bar mitzvah to which the whole world is invited, and it's soccer themed. That being in America is going to cement the profile of the sport in the US. But darkness for the next 32 days, world football's elite are going to take the field. And while our women are the defending champions next year in the Women's World Cup, our men, true darkness, did not make it. Luckily, there is a telenovela worth of storylines for Americans to catch up with. And Americans love the circus, the sporting circus, more than any other nation. They will cut work en masse to daytime drink to watch Lionel Messi try and LeBron James it with Argentina, drag his team solely to victory. Cristiano Ronaldo, few men in sports love to take their shirt off in victory more than him, with Portugal, Brazil, the Germans, Teutonic New England Patriots, defending champions even deeper than last season. Those are just the big storylines. And obviously, there's a panoply of heroes who will be unknown today but revealed over the next 32 days. Villains, wrestling heels, neck tattoos, unbelievable haircuts. It's the world's greatest soap opera unfurling live.
So, given all of that, I still don't have Team USA to root for. Besides Messi, who you already mentioned, is there anyone else that we should be thinking about? Does it matter? Should I go back to sort of, you know, my history and, I don't know, think about rooting for Spain? Like, what do we do?
Ultimately, football is a little bit like the sorting hat in Harry Potter. You do not choose a team. A team will choose themselves and reveal themselves to you, and you'll become emotionally connected to them over the course of the next month. I'm an Englishman. I've become American. I live and die with the US men's and women's team. For me, the team that I am most fascinated in engaging with and emotionally connecting is Iceland, Tanzina, that tiny nation, 325,000 people It's about as big as Corpus Christi, Texas, and they have hardwired themselves to become pound for pound the world's greatest producer of elite footballing talent. They've invested heavily over 20 years in a way America really should and will now in elite coaching and infrastructure. They have produced this team. I interviewed them in Reykjavik and they said, Viking blood flows through our veins. And I said, haha, that's really funny. And they're like, no, it really does. They believe self-confidently, tenaciously, that they can biblically smite all comers. Their coach, who's become a friend of mine, Heimir Hallmgrensson, who comes from Vestland, a tiny island with far more puffins than people, where he was the town dentist until recently, even as the international manager. It's like Northern Exposure. He was the dentist. And he told me, you know, managers, it's a crazy world, high pressure. Some managers drink, others hunt, others gamble. He said he finds it very calming doing root canal. 12 years ago, he was coaching his local under 12 team. And in a couple of days' time, he will lead out his nation into World Cup play against Argentina and Lionel Messi, and they will fancy their chances. I adore them.
Roger, I have to have you as my personal guide through this for the next month. But before we even think about that, let's do that, because I need this. I need this. However, this is not the first time the U.S. has connected with the Men's World Cup. The last time the Men's World Cup came to the United States was, as you mentioned earlier, in 1994. And Team USA did actually really well, surprisingly, making it out of the group stage. But there's a clip in your new podcast, American Fiasco, about their first game against Switzerland in Michigan, and I want people to hear it.
This is the first World Cup game ever played indoors, and Seamus, the moment has arrived for U.S. soccer. Put in perspective.
What did it feel like, John, to run out with your U.S. team at the Pontiac Silverdome before 73,000 screaming fans, the world watching, a World Cup on American turf?
God, we were fighting for the nation there. We were fighting for respect again. Like, this is our chance to shine. This is our chance to push it over the ledge. We have to, in order for this game to survive in our country, we have to do something pretty special.
Roger, but in 1998, the Americans imploded. So your podcast is called American Fiasco. Tell us about this story.
It's a American dream turned sour. It's part Apocalypse Now, part Scarface. It's really about football in the same way as Animal Farm is about horses and pigs. And it's a lesson about collective American play becoming undone by individualism and selfishness. It's a remarkable story, American Fiasco. Listen to it, Tanzina, and then we will chat again.
Absolutely. And just a reminder, we're talking about the Men's World Cup. The Women's World Cup, they're actually champions, right?
If only the men were half as good as the women, we wouldn't. We'd be watching the U.S. in action and dominating in this World Cup, that's for sure. But bring on the women, World Cup, Women's World Cup 2019. I can't wait.
Roger Bennett, you know him from Men in Blazers, and he's also the host of our new podcast, American Fiasco, from WNYC Studios. Thanks so much for being with us.
Tanzina, make great memories during the World Cup. Courage.
New York State Attorney General Barbara Underwood has sued President Donald Trump, his three eldest children, and the Trump Foundation. The lawsuit alleges broad campaign finance violations and self-dealings. In a written statement today, Attorney General Underwood said, quote, "The Trump Foundation was little more than a checkbook for payments from Mr. Trump or his businesses to nonprofits, regardless of their purpose of legality." Ilya Meretz, reporter for WNYC and a co-host of the Trump Inc. podcast, is here to explain this news to us. Ilya, thank you, as always,
sure,
for being here. So we just gave a brief summary of the lawsuit, but give us some details here. What do we know so far?
Yeah, it's a really breathtaking 41-page document that I have here with me. And in it, the New York Attorney General, Barbara Underwood, focuses on a few key areas where she says the charity went not just wrong, but really egregiously wrong. One of the key ones, actually, that many listeners will remember is in the 2016 campaign, in the primary campaign, Donald Trump had, in the midst of the Iowa caucuses, he had a kind of a charity telethon event for veterans instead of participating in a debate with the other candidates. And at that point, the charity became, according to the New York Attorney General, completely mingled with the Trump campaign. So at Trump campaign events, subsequently, Donald Trump would cut a big jumbo check and hand that out to the charity. And it would say, "Make America Great Again" on the bottom of that check. That's an egregious violation of New York state laws on charities, and I believe on federal laws to do with charities too, although state laws are the only pertinent laws in this lawsuit. There's actually a photo of one of those events with one of those jumbo checks that I just tweeted out. You can follow me at Ilya Meretz if you want to have a look at that. I also linked to the lawsuit itself. It's really good reading. So that's one area. That's to do with 2016 politics. More broadly, the New York Attorney General is saying this was a charity in name only. The board didn't exercise meaningful oversight. They didn't have a conflict of interest plan as required by law. The accounting was essentially done by the Trump Organization in Trump Tower. And the directors, including the head of the charity, Donald Trump, failed to exercise meaningful control and do what a charity is supposed to do, which is benefit the public in exchange for a tax-free status and conferring tax benefits.
Now, is this suit a legacy of our former Attorney General, Eric Schneiderman, who had to step down because of sexual harassment allegations?
Yeah, all this began 20 months ago. So this has been in process for a really long time. And I do recall not long ago when Eric Schneiderman had to resign because of revelations about his personal life and alleged abuse of his romantic partners. There was some concern about the future of this lawsuit because people knew this had been grinding along for a long time. I think what Barbara Underwood, the New York Attorney General, is saying today is whoever's the AG, we're moving ahead with this. The office is moving ahead with this.
And of course, the president hasn't wasted much time responding. The president did just tweet, and I'll read you a little bit of that tweet. It says, and I'm quoting the president here, "The sleazy New York Democrats and their now disgraced and run out of town AG Eric Schneiderman are doing everything they can do to sue me on a foundation that took in $18,800,000 and gave out to charity more money than it took in $19,200,000. $1,000. And then the president says, "I won't settle this case." Your reaction?
Well, we also have a somewhat more measured response from a spokesperson for the Trump Organization. And what I think is really interesting in that response is the following statement, and I quote, "The reason the foundation was able to donate more than it took in is because it had little to no expenses. This is unheard of for a charitable foundation." Translation: they had no staff.
Right.
There was no operation.
There was no one there.
It was entirely merged with the Trump Organization. That was a problem, according to the New York Attorney General, and it manifested itself in a lot of different ways. For example, the Trump Foundation settling lawsuits for Donald Trump or Trump hotels or Trump resorts, basically on his behalf, in matters that didn't concern the foundation in any way. Basically, if the same staff is working for Trump hotels and for Trump office buildings and also for the foundation, maybe they're not making some very needed distinctions there.
Ilya Meretz is with me from WNYC, and we're talking about the New York Attorney General who's filed a lawsuit against President Trump, his family, and the Trump Foundation. Ilya, have we ever seen anything like this? Now, I know we talked a little bit about the controversy that the Clinton Foundation had faced. Are there any parallels? Are there any differences here?
I mean, the Clinton Foundation is the first thing that comes to mind. It is the other very well-known foundation tied to a key person in politics. They've been accused of a lot of things, but certainly not of these kinds of gross violations of the basic laws of nonprofits. During the campaign, Hillary Clinton was accused of sort of using her family foundation's charitable activities, I suppose, to elevate her own profile, or perhaps that it could attract donations from people who later wanted to influence her when she became president. It's a legitimate line of inquiry. I'm not sure that anyone ever proved that that was happening. What we have here in this indictment seems to be a pretty strong case that the Trump Foundation was not run like a foundation at all.
And it also mentions the lawsuit also mentions the president's children, with over whom he's been very protective, What was their involvement in this organization?
Well, they were directors of the foundation, so they had a fiduciary duty to exercise control of spending and look at spending. What we know from the indictment and what's alleged here is that Donald Trump was the sole name on the foundation's bank accounts, and he approved all expenditures, and the board, the directors didn't do anything. Of course, all this is going to play out in court. These are allegations. But it is a really stunning lawsuit to see.
And the president had trouble finding a lawyer. So now what?
Well, that I don't know. I do not know who's handling this from his legal angle. But this is going to be an interesting suit since he says he's going to fight it and not settle.
And it's also President Trump's birthday today. Happy 72, and perhaps a difficult birthday present. Ilya Marritz, a reporter here at WNYC. Thanks for being with us on this.
You're very welcome.
Your Honor, my name is Grabir Graywall. I represent the United States in this matter.
Grabir Graywall may be the New Jersey State Attorney General, but he's no stranger to bias and discrimination.
I've experienced overt racism. I've experienced subtle racism. I've experienced these types of things in a grocery store with my young daughters with me, where people will say to me, oh, look, Osama bin Laden, or look, terrorist. And it's something that's just part of my life experience.
Grabir Graywall is the first Sikh in a statewide attorney general's role in United States history, and he says that could be an advantage.
What it allows me is a greater degree of empathy in my current job, understanding how deeply hateful comments and hateful conduct and bias and how deeply those types of words can cut. It makes me more sensitive to making sure that whenever we encounter that type of conduct, as a chief law enforcement officer, we address it appropriately.
Now, after September 11th, you decided to quit working in private practice and jump into the public sector. What was the decision that sort of, or were there a series of decisions that made you want to become a prosecutor?
Like many, I was prompted to public service to answer the call to public service after September 11th. For me, in my mind, I thought the ability to get up in front of juries looking the way I do and to say, good morning, Your Honor, my name is Grabir Graywall. I represent the United States in this matter. I think that was powerful. And I think if I could change 12 perceptions at a time or even more, that I was doing my part to show the greater community that I was part and parcel of this community, and Sikhs and others who might worship differently or look differently also care deeply about this country and have a desire to give back.
For those of us who are often the firsts, I'm a Latina, I'm in this role, I think I'm the first, you know, to be in this role. I mean, doesn't this also come with a significant amount of pressure? Do you feel that pressure that you're representing not only, you know, yourself, but also you're representing an entire religion or an entire group of people?
Sometimes even beyond just my religion, perhaps all minorities who are doing something for the first time. Yeah, I think 100%. There is an added degree of pressure, and I think there's an added degree of scrutiny because my successes are magnified and my failures are magnified. And I think I feel an extra pressure to do this job with 110% because my successes will reflect not just on me, but others who might be coming behind me. And I also feel the pressure to try to make the path for others because the first is great, but you want to be the first and you want to bring forward the second, the third, the fourth, and so on and so on. So more people who didn't think that these jobs were possible for them will be attracted to them. So it's a pressure, but it's a good pressure and I welcome it.
If you're just joining us, I'm speaking with New Jersey State Attorney General Grabir Graywall. And wanting to shift a minute to the state of New Jersey, you know, there'd been lots of talk about how your office might serve as a sort of barrier against the Trump administration. Do you see that happening?
100%. And it's just not my office. It's myself and other like-minded attorneys general across the country who are really holding the line to ensure that the rule of law still means something in this country, to ensure that the Constitution still means something, to ensure that the president is following constitutional rules and norms in whatever actions he undertakes, and importantly, to ensure the rights of all New Jerseyans and the rights of all citizens, in particular immigrant communities, minority communities who might feel under attack, are protected. And there's a coalition of like-minded attorneys general who are really holding that line.
Let's talk about criminal justice issues as well. Across the country, there are racial disparities in the criminal justice system. given your own experience of discrimination, are you aware of these racial disparities and they exist in New Jersey? And if so, do you have any or plans to have any organizational changes to the criminal justice system in New Jersey to address those?
That's a terrific question. And unfortunately, we have wide racial disparities in the criminal justice system here in New Jersey. The way we're trying to deal with it from a law enforcement perspective is to have all of our law enforcement in the state trained on implicit bias and issues related to unconscious and implicit bias. Importantly, that they never let that bias affect the way they undertake their law enforcement duties. I think that is critically important. And so through training and through those type of actions, we're hoping that has a positive effect in reducing the racial disparities in the state. That's just one aspect of it. We are also looking to other ways in which we could intervene early in our communities to ensure that we divert juveniles in particular out of the criminal justice system.
And we've been seeing there was lots of confusion over the role that ICE was playing in either separating families at the border or pulling families apart. But regardless of the confusion, we are still seeing a very stepped up presence. Do you take a specific stance on this? Are you concerned about what's happening with ICE?
I'm deeply concerned by what ICE is undertaking right now. Certainly, they have a charge to enforce the immigration laws. Where I take exception is when they are enforcing those laws in a way that drives our immigrant communities further into the shadows. And what I'm talking about there is when they are enforcing immigration laws and deportation orders in courthouses. We want victims to come forward to report crimes. We want victims to interact with law enforcement, regardless of what their immigration status is. We don't want individuals from immigrant communities to be afraid to come to a courthouse to report something to a prosecutor, to testify at trial. And unfortunately, these efforts to enforce the laws, immigration deportation orders at courthouses is having a chilling effect on people coming forward.
And we've just asked you about a lot of the big ticket items, but are there any other issues that you're looking forward to tackling as New Jersey Attorney General?
We talked about a lot of our federal-facing work, and we talked about immigration, which again comes under that title. That's a small part of what we do here in New Jersey, and that's a small part of what my mission is. I'm the chief law enforcement officer, and I would love to focus all my time on battling the opioid crisis, on battling gun violence, and on improving police-community relations. But unfortunately, I'm being distracted from those goals by the conduct of our federal government. And given the position of attorneys general, I now have to devote some time and resources to that battle, which is a critically important battle. So if I didn't have to focus on D.C. as well, I would be focusing on those three areas.
New Jersey State Attorney General Grabir Graywall, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much for your time.
The world's worst humanitarian crisis could be getting even worse this week. An estimated 8 million people are at risk of starvation in Yemen. And on Wednesday, a Saudi-led coalition started launching attacks on the port city of Hodeidah. That port is the entry for about 80% of the country's humanitarian aid. Iona Craig is an investigative journalist who has covered the conflict in Yemen extensively. Iona, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
So we mentioned Hodeidah is the port city. Why the focus on this city and how critical is this?
Well, the focus on the city, as far as the Saudi and UAE-led coalition is concerned, is they've always claimed that Iran, who the Houthi rebels are allied to, has been supplying weapons and ballistic missiles to the Houthis that have been coming through the port of Hodeidah. But that's slightly extraordinary because all vessels going into the port of Hodeidah have been checked and are monitored by a UN set up vessel monitoring system that's been in place now since 2016. And even some of those vessels are checked in Saudi Arabia before they go to Yemen. But that's the reason the coalition give. And also their, I think, hope is that by making this military offensive on Hodeidah and that being successful, that it should then push the Houthis to the negotiating table. But as you've already said, it's crucial really for humanitarian aid and commercial goods that go into Yemen, because it feeds almost two-thirds of the Yemeni population, that lifeline port, because the northwest of Yemen, where it's located, is the most densely populated part of the country, which still remains under Houthi control.
And there are people who, in the country who are already facing extensive famine. Do you expect this will exacerbate that?
Absolutely. I don't think there's any doubt that it will exacerbate that. The port was closed along with the rest of Yemen entirely to humanitarian aid briefly last year by the Saudi coalition because of this issue of ballistic missiles being fired by the Houthis into the kingdom and their insistence that these missiles were coming through Hodeidah. And even in that short time when that happened, the humanitarian aid agencies were really struggling to get important food supplies and medical equipment and other aid into the country. So the other alternatives are obviously by road, but that's many thousands of miles. That increases the price of all of these goods and the logistics is very difficult. So Hodeidah is really essential to keeping a lot of Yemenis alive. And there's 22 million of them now in need of humanitarian aid. And of course, this kind of military offences will only increase those numbers and increase the people who are now vulnerable to severe malnutrition and on the brink of famine.
What do you expect the international reaction to be?
Well, certainly from the UN and its agencies as well, the humanitarian agencies and the aid agencies involved in Yemen, they've been doing their best to try and stop this from happening. The UN Special Envoy to Yemen, Martin Griffiths, who was appointed in March, has been making huge efforts in the last few weeks to try and broker a deal which would see the port of Hodeidah being put under UN control to keep all sides happy in the conflict and to prevent this kind of assault. I think that the US, from their perspective, certainly the statements that have been made have been viewed as what's called, you know, like a yellow light or an amber light on this offensive, because they've been slightly ambiguous in their take on it. They've said that the port should remain open for humanitarian aid, but they haven't actually called for the coalition and the UAE and the Saudis not to go ahead with this offensive. And the US has been involved in this conflict from the beginning, both with intelligence, mid-air refueling for the fighter jets, and with a presence in Saudi Arabia as well in helping to protect the border. But I think in the last few days, we certainly had reports that the US has become more involved in selecting targets, particularly in Hodeidah, for this operation. And I think their role in this could be very crucial. If the US decides to get more involved militarily, let's say because the coalition gets bogged down in this offensive on Hodeidah and it doesn't happen cleanly and quickly, which I think is very unlikely that it will, that will draw the US more into this conflict and more involved militarily. And that's obviously a concern of what the response would be to that, particularly from Iran, who are already allied to the Houthis, if that would also suck them further into the conflict in Yemen.
Iona Craig is an investigative journalist who covers the conflict in Yemen. Iona, thanks so much for being with us.
Good to talk to you.
Well, I'm getting ready to watch a video.
Really? What?
Oh, just some scary movie.
You like scary movies?
Uh-huh.
What's your favorite scary movie?
Almost everyone has a favorite horror movie, like Drew Barrymore there in Scream. And within the past couple of years, there have been some great new additions to the genre. We had Get Out, A Quiet Place, and last weekend, a new movie called Hereditary opened. And it got us here at The Takeaway thinking about how the horror film genre has changed over time. Newsday and Takeaway film critic Rafer Guzman has some thoughts, and he's here with Allison Wilmore, critic and culture writer for BuzzFeed News, joining me in the studio today. Hi, everybody.
Hey there.
Hey.
So let's quickly talk about Hereditary. What's it about? Why the buzz?
Well, it's about a family dealing with grief, with a death in the family that kind of spirals out into these twin, like, intense family dramas, and then maybe something supernatural unfolding parallel to that. And it goes to some very dark places.
As it should, talking about the genre. But what we're hearing is that critics seem to like it and viewers not so much. Rafer.
Yeah, that's right. It's an unusual case. You know, there is something out there called CinemaScore that people may or may not know about, where it's basically an opening day polling company just to get the opinions of, you know, your average moviegoer. You read these scores, you know, over the years, and you get this. I at least get a fairly dim opinion of the movie going public because they will just give a pretty good grade to just absolute dreck. Like they still love the Transformers movies. They're still just totally excited about those things. But, you know, you get an A, your movie's going to do pretty well. You get a B, you know, it's a little dicey. A C, you're definitely in trouble. Hereditary got a D plus.
Now, this pretty bad.
This
right?
is unusual. I mean... that's just a couple notches shy of absolute total failure. And yet, the critics have just been fawning over themselves over this. I mean, they are treating this like this is going to be another Oscar bait movie, which I really think it could be. And it's also been doing really well at the box office. So you really have this kind of split between, I think, sort of adventurous moviegoers and then kind of the average moviegoing public.
So I want to back up a second, because initially, right before we came on air, I was telling you all that I hate horror movies, that they scare me. They scare me to levels that I can't even. But I have seen some of them. I'm curious about the cycle. Like, in this country, there seems to be a fascination and a love of horror. Do these movies come in batches? Do they come in cycles? Do they reflect what's happening in our society? Like, I'm just wondering. Yeah.
Well, I think that we're seeing a particular, I don't know, golden age of what you might call art house horror. And I would put Hereditary in that kind of pile. These movies like It Follows or The Witch, these movies that are kind of really beautifully made, also very scary. But also, I think, to speak to the CinemaScore, they don't follow the usual patterns or formulas of a horror movie, which some people really are bothered by. And I think Hereditary kind of almost defies a lot of your expectations in that regard. So I think that we're seeing something there. And I would put even Get Out in that as well. You know, this is a movie that really was horror, but also spoke to a lot of people beyond that for, you know, social reasons and for resonance.
And that's actually one of the films I did see, making sure I did not go alone and went and came out when it was still light out. but seriously, I mean, this type of horror film, I know people who are horror fanatics who will say things like this was so stupid, or the you know, the special effects were cheesy or whatever. Right. Like, what makes a good horror film?
You know, to me, and this is one of the things I like about Hereditary. To me, I think you've really got to feel for the characters, first of all. I think that's really important. And it's something that horror films, I think, by and large, don't really do that well. I think they depend on a visceral reaction. Oh my God, I'm any human being, and I'm going to scream when someone's plunging a knife toward me. But to really make people care about the people that are on the screen is difficult. And, you know, Hereditary has got this incredible cast, and you've got this incredible actress, Toni Collette, in the lead role. And I'm just going to say, a lot of times what you're seeing on screen is not necessarily that bloody, that gross, that disturbing. The movie definitely gets there, as Allison and I both know. But what really, I think, upset me in that movie was seeing Toni Collette's face. She's got this, she's a very expressive actress. She's got a very unique face, a very unique facial structure. And when she contorts her face into a scream of real agony, real emotional pain, I just don't think that many audiences out there are ready for that. It really gets under your skin. To me, I think that is the mark of a great horror movie. The Exorcist, The Shining, movies that really do that, that really get at you in an emotional way.
And are we seeing a difference these days? You mentioned art house horror films. Are we talking more about thrillers? Because to me, when I watched Get Out, until the very end, no spoilers, there isn't a lot of blood and guts, right? I mean, right. It really is a psychological thriller. Is that where we're headed with horror? Are we moving away from the era of Chucky and The Exorcist and all that other stuff?
Well, I think we're still seeing, you know, your kind of slashers, your traditional horror movies. You know, I think that Blumhouse, which is the company that actually produced Get Out, and they produce a lot of kind of lower budget, but sometimes very innovative horror movies, they put out a lot of, you know, what would be called mainstream horror. And I think that's still very alive and thriving. But I don't know. I'm not usually someone who kind of guards the boundaries of genres. And I think that there's a lot of room in horror. And there's a lot of places where you see horror creeping into other things as well. Season 2 of Atlanta was like very horror influenced. I think that it just seems to speak to something for people today, maybe in this current age of anxiety and dread for some people.
Yeah, let's
seeing
talk
that
about
on
that.
Screen.
Let's talk about something. This current age of anxiety, because I don't know about you guys, but I'm a little anxious. And I wonder, are people watching horror films to escape? I can't imagine this being an escape. For me, I watch comedy. I'll turn on, you know, we talked about cooking shows. I love that because it's no narrative. It's no stress. But do people use this as an escape?
Yeah, it's hard to say. You know, I'm the kind of person that always tends to look for some kind of zeitgeist explanation for everything, which is often a fool's errand. But It's difficult to pinpoint something as clear as, let's say, in the 50s, when that spate of science fiction films were all very clearly about communist, you know, invasion and, you know, fears of a takeover of the nation. That was clear. I don't know if I'm really seeing that in the horror genre. I'm not sure if I'm seeing a real clear theme or thread that makes me say, ah, there's this one anxiety that's kind of nagging at America's psyche. You know, I mean, because as Allison said, you've got everything from the Insidious movies, which are just your classic, you know, I'm the medium in the room conjuring the ghost, and mm-hmm. I've got to go to the other side. And, you know, to haunted house movies like Winchester, not a very good movie, but a mm-hmm. traditional example of like the spooky mansion movie. To things like The Witch, total art house stuff, Babadook, you know, another art house film. So it's really across the board. You're really just seeing the genre itself kind of go all over the place.
And interestingly, the movie Get Out, which I thought, you know, did really, really well, surprisingly well. And I think that was something that connected with a lot of people because of its topic. Now, as we know, movies are lacking in diversity, particularly horror films. I interviewed Marlon Wayans a bunch of years ago when he was getting into the horror movie genre, and he said, you know, I'm not trying to make a black horror movie. I'm just making a horror movie. What are your thoughts, Allison, on that?
Well, I think we're still waiting on when we're going to see Hollywood trying to follow in the path of Get Out. Hollywood usually does not show a great deal of imagination in that when something works, you know. And Jordan Peele is kind of the hottest talent out there right now and is getting so many like different offers and deals. But I think we're still kind of waiting on seeing more diverse horror. I mean, certainly A Quiet Place and Hereditary are very, you know, white-dominated films. But I'm hopeful. I would like to see horror speak more to a bigger demographic.
Get Out 2, Jordan. Get Out 2. Rafer Guzman is a film critic for Newsday and The Takeaway, and Allison Wilmore is a film critic for BuzzFeed. That's our show for today. Do you have a favorite horror movie, or are they all just too scary for you? Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or let us know on Twitter. We're at The Takeaway. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway.